Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The passenger pigeon, which may have been the most numerous bird on the planet, made its home in the forest that once covered North America east of the Rocky Mountains. In the 19th century, their flocks, a mile wide and up to 300 miles long, were so dense that they darkened the sky for hours and days as they passed overhead. Yet human exploitation drove this species to extinction over the course of a few decades. Author and naturalist Joel Greenberg has written about the passenger pigeon's demise and the importance of conservation in his new book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. He joins us on the phone from his home in Illinois. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, Mindy. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. So now when we hear the name pigeon, many automatically think of the pigeons that we see in urban areas, but passenger pigeons were a completely different species, more closely related to the mourning dove. So describe their appearance.
Well, the way I describe in the book is they look like mourning doves on steroids. They were bigger by a third. The males had red breasts. The backs were bluer. The females were somewhat similar in pattern, but beige below. And they turns out with genetic research, although they resemble mourning doves, they're actually closer to another group of pigeons a group of New World pigeons that includes the Western species called band-tailed. And they differed from mourning doves very profoundly in their behavior. They laid only one egg, and so they flocked. They flew faster, more powerful, and had a much more conspicuous appearance.
Yeah, and their call was different. The mourning dove makes that nice little coo.
It does, and the descriptions of passenger pigeon sounds, you know, range from some people said they would kind of coo or make shrieks. In the aggregations when they gathered in the hundreds of millions, it was described as something terrifying. And yet another, a minister from New York, said they sound like the sighing of the old trees. That's quite lovely, and so it sounds like people were really described it fairly differently from one person to another.
It's hard to say. So how did you get interested in the story of passenger pigeons?
Well, I've always been interested in animals, and I've been an avid birder since the age of 12, and if you're interested in North American birds, you read about the pigeon, and my interests evolved a bit to focusing on how people have altered the North American landscape. I've written three books about that. Mm-hmm. So you can't help but just be overwhelmed by the descriptions of the pigeon, and I'd long thought about writing a book about this species, and this year's anniversary that it was coming up, made the project of greater currency, made it more interesting, and so that's what I've been doing the last few years.
Right, and we say anniversary, 100 years since the last passenger pigeon died. So this story of the passenger pigeon is as much about their extinction as it is about the sheer number of the birds before their decline. Even early European explorers were amazed at the abundance when they arrived in North America, and reading about it, I was shocked. I had no idea there were so many.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't know how many there were. There was nobody doing scientific surveys. Those didn't even exist. But when you take the accounts, as you say, from the very beginning, and so for 300 years, people writing in a multitude of languages described these from, as you said, Audubon traveled along the Ohio River in Kentucky, and in the course of that 3 days, the birds darkened the sky. Wilson, a contemporary of his, saw a flock, sat there with a pencil, tried to make calculations, came up with 2 billion of them. And even as late as 1860, there was a flight near Toronto described by Ross King of the British Army. And he never gave a number to it, but he described them in great detail. And modern scholars have made a few assumptions and said he saw, depending on how fast the birds were flying, anywhere from 2 to 3.7 billion birds. Mm,
it's amazing.
And that's just 40 years before the population collapsed to virtually zero.
And so before the European settlers arrived, it's estimated that passenger pigeons made up 25% to 40% of the birds in North America. Is this an anomaly in this regard? Are there record numbers of other bird species that amass those kinds of numbers?
Well, right now there's a sparrow-like bird in Africa that's supposed to be the most abundant bird in the world right now. But that figure takes, so if you say there were 3 to 5 billion passenger pigeons, and there have been estimates of what the total population of North American birds were, and so that's where that 25 to 40% figure comes from. So it's just basically saying, okay, how many individual birds were there, and then 3 to 5 billion of them were this one species.
Yeah. Let's talk about the biology and life cycle of the passenger pigeon. What was their range and migratory pattern?
Sure. They range from the Atlantic to the, as you described, to the Great Plains, from James Bay to the north to the to the Gulf States. Their movements were spectacular, as we've been describing, but they didn't migrate like, say, warblers with a strict phenological pattern going north in spring and south in the fall. Their movements were largely dictated by their need for food, and they preferred the nuts of beech and oak. So where there were masting incidents, masting is the process where these trees periodically produce a surfeit of seeds, and so they moved around the landscape in search of food. So more like cedar waxwings or red crossbills do today. And again, it's more forage-based than north and south. So they've nested. One year, there was a big nesting in the spring in Mississippi. One year, they were seen in James Bay at the southern end of Hudson Bay in December. So the birds could show up any place, any time, and in fact, that's how they got their name, passenger pigeon.
Hmm. You're mentioning the mainstay of the diet were tree nuts, acorns, beech nuts, chestnuts. The forest nuts or mast would vary in abundance, as you're saying, from place to place, year to year. The mystery, though, that remains today is that the birds seem to know where the best foraging would be, and so they would go to these locations. So what are some theories on how did they know?
Well, that's a great question, and I've talked to some one ornithologist who studied red crossbills. So the idea being that when they were migrating, just moving, they would often fly in a broad front, okay? So you think about geese flying in a V. Well, this would be more, as I said, just maybe a long line moving, and that way they could scan a wide range of the ground. They had good eyesight, they often flew low, and so if they saw something, then they had apparently the recollection to say, on our way back, we can, when it's time to breed, or we can utilize this food. Also, because they were in one place one year, so the acorns were thick in Pennsylvania, then they would know pretty much they're not going to be thick the next year. Mm-hmm. So, and it was, some of it then was memory. And the other aspect is, as birds are flying, and this happens today, they've done studies, if birds are flying and they're noticing a lot more birds flying in a certain direction, they tend to follow each other. And so they give each other cues as to where food might be.
Yeah, so that's like following the little chickadees. As you know, you watch the chickadees, the other birds will follow because they're usually the first one at the food source.
Absolutely, yeah. You definitely, especially in the fall with little flocks of warblers, the chickadees or something will alert you first, and then you see these other birds appearing.
Yeah, so let's talk about the nut. They would eat these acorns or nuts whole, and sometimes I guess you have that disc shape like in their neck as they're holding these nuts, and they could rattle.
Absolutely. There was a space by their esophagus called the crop, and what they would do is eat acorns and beets. They didn't really actually eat chestnuts as much, it would appear, but they would open their mouths and open their mouths wide and could swallow them whole, as you say, and sometimes as many as 12 of these acorns would be lodged there. And so what they would do is perch after eating, and then over the hours, it would eventually get digested and you know, be processed in the gastrointestinal tract. If somebody shot them, and as you say, one writer said they literally rattled. Somebody else said that, you know, he emptied them out and found 12 or 13 of them.
Amazing. So these migrations that we're talking about, they were spectacular. Observers reported the sky was darkened by the huge flocks that passed overhead. But equally impressive was the speed at which they flew. I guess these birds were designed for speed. So describe what made them so fast and about these flocks.
Well, they had powerful muscles, and they needed to be able to fly fast and far. Because again, they were always moving, and you know, if they need, they preferred these nuts, particularly during breeding. So they had to; they couldn't rely on food supplies right next to where they were nesting, say, as other birds do. So they had to be able to reach these forage sites in a way that would get them back to the nesting grounds. And in terms of the migration, there's an example, one day in the spring of 1854, the people of Columbus, Ohio, looked up and they saw some clouds, and then they began to hear a humming sound, and pretty soon the clouds came close and they realized they were passenger pigeons. The sky was dark for 2 or 3 hours, and for people who were who didn't know this phenomenon, some dropped to their knees in prayer, thinking the end times had come. Other people got chilled because of the downdraft from hundreds of millions of wings. So, you know, and you don't have to, Mindy, you didn't have to go. If you wanted to see bison, you'd have to go to the plains of western Kansas. But to see these amazing flocks, and it wasn't every year, but you would have a pretty good chance if you lived anywhere in between, you know, the Rockies and the Atlantic coast. So it was a familiar sight to people of the 19th century.
Right. And the sound, I know I was interested in hearing when some of these recollections people had, like, it sounded like, you know, a thunderstorm or a tornado, you know, coming through. That had to be, you know, pretty scary at first until you realize what it is. I mean, your first experience with one of those must have been a scary experience.
Oh, absolutely. And there's an account of some folks. The largest nesting ever occurred in central Wisconsin in 1871, and some hunters went there. They had a guide, and so they were there before light, and the birds had a pattern where the males would leave early in the morning to go feed. They'd come back in the middle of the day. Then the females would feed. They'd come back mid-afternoon, and then the males would do a late-afternoon flight. Well, they were there for this big morning flight, and this was an area, this nesting, again, covering hundreds of square miles, including hundreds of 136 million birds was one estimate. And he said that these guys had guns. They're waiting there. That's what they, but they were terrified by just that eruption in the morning. They said it was like a railroad in a car in a tunnel or cannon. And so they used the most powerful language they could to describe this site. And almost some of these descriptions are almost biblical in their aspect.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading, I was thinking. I don't know if you've seen the long-tailed ducks. You know, that will feed off of Nantucket, and they go out in, you know, in the morning, and they come back, and it's like watching these tunnels of smoke as the, you know, and you go, how many birds are there? And that seems like nothing now. When you look at how the numbers of the passengers pigeons in these flocks.
Oh yeah, have you seen they're widely they're on the internet, those susurrations of starlings?
Yes, yes.
And you know, you look at that and that's pretty spectacular. And then I think multiply that by 1,000 or, you know,
yeah,
a billion, and it gets to be as I say, difficult. Each generation has its own baseline, and I've asked birders what's the most number of birds you've seen. I mean, I saw about 500,000 snow geese in Nebraska once, and Somebody said that if you sit on a certain spot on in Washington State, you can watch sooty shearwaters going along the shore, and they had a million of them. Well, that sounds unbelievable, but these flocks were hundreds of times.
Yeah, it's amazing. We're talking with Jill Greenberg. His book is A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. We'll talk more after a quick break.